Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Susan Oxley, from Seattle, Washington, in the United States. This is the series Climate Brewing, and today I'm interviewing my good friend Joan Thompson from Kitchener, Ontario, Canada, an hour west of Toronto. I have known Joan for, many, many years. I'd say at least 25. And we worked together in a variety of ministerial roles early on, and now we are both members of the North American Climate Justice Team. Joan tells me she's learned a lot on the North American Climate Justice Team, and we're going to share a little bit of some of the things that she has learned and become interested in during the 3 years, 4 years that we've been working. So welcome, Joan.
It's good to be here, Susan, and it's good to be back with you again.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here. Joan, as you know, we're moving into the camping season in the Northern Hemisphere with youth camps and reunions, and we've been getting ready for reunions in various places. The reunion materials for this year focus on the environment and climate change. It's called Heal the Earth. And as we start attending events at campgrounds and once again assessing what our campground needs are, I'd like to talk about the vulnerability of our campgrounds to the effects of climate change. Can you share with me some of the things that you see in terms of how vulnerable our campgrounds are in the face of the current climate emergency and changes in climate patterns and weather?
Thanks, Susan. Yes. When we started looking at campgrounds, the climate team, way back in March of 2021, we did a webinar focused on the kind of unique and different things several campgrounds, several mission centers, several congregations are doing to reduce their carbon footprint, the typical kinds of things, and also to increase their biodiversity, the typical things that we think about when we're thinking about how to use our land and how to be good stewards. Then in September of 2022, we did a couple of sessions called Climate Crises and Sacred Spaces, our campgrounds. And the team did a lot of research into the various risks our campgrounds are facing. It was really eye-opening. We had no idea of the kinds of risks that are starting to be evident now and will be increasingly a factor in the future. So let me just name a few. Mm-hmm. The first one that comes to people's mind will be heat. The number of extreme heat days is increasing. The temperatures are increasing. The heat-related deaths are increasing. We're at 500,000 people a year and climbing from heat-related deaths. And we tend to think that those are in underdeveloped countries, but they're happening everywhere. Then we've got the risk on our coastal properties of sea level rise, but even on the inland properties, the risk of floods is increasing, and at the same time, the risk of drought is increasing. So that's all going to affect our campgrounds. And then there's wind. Winds are stronger than they used to be. And so we're seeing more wind damage, more trees coming down in windstorms, things like that. And then the big one in my mind is fire. Almost all of our campgrounds are surrounded by trees. And the risk of forest fire and local fires is increasing. And along with fire comes smoke. And we saw last summer how far the smoke can go from forest fires raging in the north Well, just the smoke itself can be toxic, and the chemicals that are sprayed to fight those forest fires bond with the ash and create toxic particulates that are very small, get into people's lungs and cause very serious lung damage. So we've got a lot of issues facing our campgrounds.
Yes, we do. When you name them like that, it just seems overwhelming. But even now, what can some of the camp boards and managers and directors do to help make our campgrounds more ecologically safe and resilient?
Oh, that's a huge topic. I think the first thing is to get educated and to become better educated about the risks and both the options for mitigating the risks. For instance, in Canada, we have an organization called the INTACT, that's INTACT, the INTACT Center for Climate Action. And it works with universities, think tanks, government, and it's produced a number of brochures that are available to download for free on all of the different risks and how to make your property, whether it's a homeowner property or a commercial property or a larger property, as resilient as possible. So that's a great place to start, a great overview. For instance, for the fire risk, talking to the local fire departments, if you've got a department of the forestry, in your local area, in your state or province, talk to them. Talk to Indigenous elders if you can, learn where, how to contact them in your local area, because our First Nations people have been caring for this landscape for thousands, tens of thousands of years. And they've learned a lot. They have a lot of wisdom that we've ignored up until now. And so there's a lot of information that can be found in terms of what needs to be done in the long run. And then people can start developing a plan for a long range plan on how to make some changes to the campground. One of the fastest things that we can do, especially in the camps that have the highest heat risk, is to look at changing our programs. One of the simplest things I've come across is the idea of reversing the order of what we normally do. Camps I've been at, study in the morning and play in the afternoon. And so people are indoors in the morning and outdoors in the afternoon. As the heat goes up, let's reverse that. Let's do all of our outdoor things in the morning or in the later evening and do our indoor activities in the afternoon. Another thing that can be done quickly, some of our campgrounds, the buildings are air conditioned, some of them they're not. But increasing insulation in the ceiling or putting insulation in the ceiling can help to cool the buildings using sails, a system of sails where you want to be outside or even over the top of the building. Can also help to reduce the heat in the buildings. So there's some relatively inexpensive and fast things that can be done to start protecting people. Have a good supply of masks. I know masks are very controversial, but when we get into smoke from forest fires, it's a good idea to have masks.
If I were a director right now, what kinds of things would you suggest I do before reunion begins, say in 3 weeks, to be ready for heat-related difficulties among the people?
Contact your public health department and get some recommendations from them. A lot of cooling stations, a lot of water stations, a lot more indoor activities where it's cooler. I was just reading a newsletter from Catherine Hayhoe. She's one of our favorite climate scientists. And in one of her most recent newsletters, she talks about the fact that she lives in Texas and they're used to heat in Texas and they've never had heat stroke. And in the last year, every single member of her family has suffered from heat stroke, some of them multiple times. So I don't think most of us are aware of the difference between a normally hot day when we feel hot, but everything's fine, and just that couple of degrees hotter when we're more apt to get heat stroke.
Yeah, and heat stroke doesn't just go away once you drink some water and rest for an hour. Heat stroke quite often requires several days to actually get over to recuperate, and you're more prone to heat stroke after you've had it once.
I
Okay.
might su suggest also opening the pool multiple times a day rather than just once a day.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share with us in terms of like floods and wind and things like that? Are there things that campground boards or managers need to be thinking of to prepare for that kind of disaster?
Yes, winds and fire go together in some ways. You want to be making sure, very first thing is that you've got an escape route if there's a fire. One of the exercises I've done is to visually go through the way out of camp, driving down that road. And imagining every tree beside the road on fire and the winds whipping it up because forest fires create their own winds. So, if the trees are too close to the road, if the tree canopy grows over the road, imagine that all on fire and you trying to get your family out safely. So
Horrifying.
horrifying, terrifying. And one of the parts of our webinars back in September, when Paul Bethel was researching campgrounds in the West, he came across a logging camp close to where our Camp Buckhorn is that almost could not get out during a forest fire because the road was blocked and they did not have a secondary exit. So that would be another recommendation is look for an emergency secondary exit, even if you need to coordinate that with your neighbors. If your lot is on fire, you guys can come out, through our property and we'll do the same. But clearing the trees and clearing the brush along your roadways. I mean, I love walking along a tree-shaded road. I love it when the leaves are overhead. It's just so beautiful. But if there's a fire, and the risk of fire is increasing because most of forest fires are caused by lightning strikes. And lightning happens everywhere. And so, as we have more dead trees and dead branches in our forested and wood areas, the risk is there for all of us. So that would be the first thing I would recommend is make sure you've got safe escape routes in case of a fire.
Okay, thank you very much.
Susan, you also asked about wind, and I meant to talk about wind because that's important. The velocity of wind storms is increasing, and wind storms are being felt over larger areas. So people are having tornadoes where they've never had tornadoes, but the big one is hurricane strength winds. They're going a lot farther inland than they used to and covering a lot more territory. Well, we want to have trees around our main buildings. They're a great source of cooling. But we also want those trees to not come down on those buildings in a windstorm. And the way to manage that is to have them shaped. We learned this a couple of years ago when there was what's called a derecho, went through southwestern Ontario and took out a whole lot of trees. We lost a spruce tree in our backyard. There were five trees come down on our street in about a 60-second period. And one of
Wow.
the things we learned after that was that most trees can survive those kinds of windstorms if their crown area is thin enough and if they're shaped properly, the limbs are shaped properly, so there's no crisscrossing limbs going, through. They're shaped more like a natural fountain so that the wind can easily go through there. And I would highly recommend campgrounds to look at the shaping and the possible reshaping and pruning of trees around their main buildings.
I believe that's called wind sailing. And professional arborists are very good at assessing how to wind sail the canopy of a tree. Even though it would cost a little bit of money to take care of that around on trees that are right around buildings at the campground, it's a lot less expensive than trying to replace the buildings.
It certainly is. Or the people who are in the building.
Or the people who are in the buildings that can't be replaced.
Yes.
So, yeah, thank you for adding that piece of information. I appreciate it.
Okay. We went to a maple sugar bush this spring. Our daughter has a new housemate who's from the Philippines who had never seen maple sugar or maple syrup or anything like that. So we took her to a maple sugar bush, which is basically a large woodlot on a farm. And I was impressed with what good shape the woodlot was in. There were no dead trees. There was no low-growing brush. The trees were well spaced. Every single winter, they go in and they take out dead trees. They trim the bush back, the low-growing brush back, and they thin the trees to make sure that light can get in to the ground around the tree canopy so that the trees remain healthy. That's the kind of thing that would be ideal for us to do around our campgrounds. It can be done in cooperation again with other neighbors. We don't all need to have the equipment. If one person has this piece of equipment and another person has that piece of equipment, and we could even run camps in the winter training people on how to thin out the woods to keep them healthier to minimize their risk of catching fire in the first place. So I was just pleased when we went to this woodlot that somebody who's doing this commercially was able to reinforce everything we've been learning about the importance of managing for fire safety, especially, but also the health of the trees, all of the bush areas that we have around us. It would take some creative thinking and brainstorming to come up with efficient ways to manage that for our campgrounds people, but it could be done.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you. Let's shift a little bit now. One of the ideas that we have come across in our webinars and our research is the possibility of making whatever land we have available that we have access to more ecologically sound more of a center of restoration and renewal.
Oh, absolutely. One of our recent webinars was on permaculture. That was in March of this year. Kelda Lorax from Oregon did a presentation for us on the concept of permaculture. It's a fascinating concept that's basically designing your landscape to be resilient. So it increases your resilience by following the ecological principles, looking at taking really deep looks at your land in terms of where the sun comes up, where the sun goes down, what's sunny, what's shady, what the elevation is, what are the high areas, what are the low areas, and coming up with a design, working with your existing buildings to help make that area more higher in biodiversity, but also ecologically sustainable and usable for all life, human and animal life within the area. So that would be a great place, once you've done your research, to find out what your risks are and what kind of things need to happen over the next 10 or so years when you're ready to start your long-term plan, long-term design, bring in a permaculture design expert and have a look at that.
Yeah, one of the ideas that came out of that I was interested in was creating a food forest along one of the well-traveled trails on your campground, and intentionally plant bushes, herbs, vegetables along there that people could graze on when they actually are on the campgrounds. They could snack on stuff that they would pick up along the trail as they move from one part of the campground to another. And so, for instance, you could plant some berry bushes. You could plant some small strawberry bushes low to the ground. You could plant snap peas or pea pods. People could just pluck them and enjoy them along the way, and it would turn that area of the campgrounds into a pleasant and functional produce area that when people weren't snacking on it, could actually be harvested and used in the kitchen.
I think that's a great idea too, and they can be visually attractive and low maintenance, and they can also help feed the animals, the local animals.
Absolutely.
Too. So we need to be generous and sharing. In the campgrounds that I'm currently at, someone has planted a lot of lilies around the treed areas around the main buildings. And they're edible lilies.
Oh.
And so when they flower, the cooks use them as garnishes for salads. And they taste pretty good. So there's a lot of interesting ways to make your landscape design beautiful and functional at the same time.
What a great idea. So what's keeping us from pursuing those kinds of ideas, besides the fact that we don't think of them, but what else is keeping us from doing these kinds of things to make our campgrounds safer, more functional, and more ecologically renewing?
I think that most campground boards, the people are currently overwhelmed with recovering from the effects of COVID, getting camps fully operational again, dealing with, in many cases, decreased numbers of campers and decreased numbers of volunteers. And so that's just the reality, that people are overwhelmed. There's opportunity that can reduce the overwhelm of looking at this. One of the things I've thought about is many of the places where we have campgrounds, our neighbors are in the same boat and they don't know it either. Our neighbors are also surrounded by heavily treed areas and they're also facing the same risks. And so there's an opportunity here, which I think is a missional opportunity, to invite the neighbors in for presentations, bring in speakers for presentations around these subjects and talk to the neighbors and brainstorm and see how we can help each other. I think that there's a real opportunity there. There's also a missional opportunity as we look at making our campgrounds as resilient as possible and as disaster-proof as possible to make them emergency gathering centers for the neighborhood. So I think that that would help if people on the boards know that they don't have to do it all themselves, be part of a neighborhood team.
Yes, and if those of us who enjoy the campgrounds would commit to giving a little bit more time and attention to the campgrounds as volunteers, that would help too.
And we could sponsor kind of camps, like work camps, where we not only, where we invite the neighbors to come and people, you know, local people, and get the theory, well, let's go out to our bush lot here and practice. We'll practice by cleaning up this section and then we'll all get good at it.
That sounds good. Is there anything else you would like to share with us before we close?
It's all doable. I think that it's all manageable if we realize that we don't have to do it all at once. We don't have to do it all today. If we're, most of our campgrounds have aging infrastructure that's going to have to be replaced at some point. And so if we look at, as we need to replace things, what's the best way to do it to make it as environmentally friendly as possible, but also as people friendly as possible in terms of surviving and thriving in a radically different climate than what we've known before, that taking it in stages and in small bites makes it doable. And if we're involving the neighbors in the conversation, I don't mean just the immediate neighbors, but hopefully, you know, a broad area of people. It's also being missional in that it's getting us known and it's possibly developing and increasing our resource base and our possibly even our pool of volunteer base. So I would just encourage boards to get started at looking at the threats for their local area. And of course, the climate team is always ready and able and willing to help any board that would like us to come and talk to them or talk to them by Zoom and help them assess where they need to be looking at.
Thank you so much, Joan. It's been a joy talking to you, and I appreciate your wisdom and all the research you've done. And I enjoy having a chance to do a podcast with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a delight for me as well.